Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And before I forget it, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come and speak here at this convention. And I just wish they would have picked a little later time. I'm not a morning person. Especially since I've been retired, I don't hardly even get up before now, you know. I love AA, and I didn't when I first came here, but I do now. I drank for a long time, and I've been sober for quite a long time, and you can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. I used to drink. I better throw that in case you think I'm some kind of an imposter or something. You know, I drank a lot. And I did a little behind the gym drinking in high school, but I started the serious stuff about when I was about 18 years old. And I went into a bar when I was 18 years old in Los Angeles, and I ordered a drink. And they served me. And you're supposed to be 21. I passed for 21. The guy gave me my drink. Immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man. And a man can buy a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. And I graduated right then and there. I didn't need to learn one thing more. I had arrived. And what else is there, you know? And I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I was comfortable there, and I could sit at the bar, and as old Norm A. used to say, I just seemed to get better looking after each drink. And I just went back every opportunity from then on I drank on a regular basis. From then on, alcohol was the focal point of my life. And I was under the influence for the next 30 years. I don't mean I was drunk all the time, but I was under the influence of alcohol for the next 30 years. And I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls, you know? And only funny thing about her is she didn't drink. I thought, what the hell are you doing here? You know, drink. This is the place to drink, you know. And anyway, we got married, and we had a turbulent marriage, put it that way. You know, I listened to Wallace last night, and he practically told my story, my drinking story. After I married for a good long time, we had two kids, and I drank my wife away, I drank my kids away, I drank my home away, I drank everything away except my job. And that was shaky, and I moved to a little garage house in Hermosa Beach, California. It was an old garage that they had made some living quarters in. It was a big room is what it amounted to. And I bought a turntable and 10 speakers, and I had a speaker in every corner, behind the drapes, behind the couch, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, you name it, I had a speaker there. And a typical day back then for me was to wake up and it'd be 10 o'clock in the morning. And I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man, I'd throw my clothes on, get in that car, weave in and out of traffic, and I knew by the time I got there there'd be a note on my desk, see the boss, you're fired. You know, I knew it was going to happen today, and that was the only thing I had left was my job. I had drank everything else away. That was my last little bit of respectability. I worked for a big company. They had put my name on one of their business cards, and that's who I was. You know, and I was driving to work, and I had this feeling of impending doom that you hear about here in AA. I had never heard that expression until I came to AA, but that's the feeling I had. I had the feeling of impending doom. You know, I should have worked yesterday. I left all these papers all over my desk. I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were too old to turn in. If I didn't turn them in, I was going to be fired for holding them. And I knew today was the day. And I'd get there and everything appeared to be the same. So I could relax a little. I'd go get a cup of coffee and come back to my desk and shuffle papers and make excuses and try to look interested until a respectable time to go to lunch came, you know. I'd get out of there about 25 after 11, you know. Just cutting it as close as I can because I needed a drink. And I went next door to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And they sold martinis over there. And I like martinis. And they sold double martinis during the lunch hour for $1. And the regular martinis back then was 75 cents. You know, by the way, you can tell that was a long time ago. I was in a nice restaurant recently, and they wanted $6.75 for a single martini. My God, how the hell, I don't know how you people drink. I would have had to make my own or something. I don't know. I couldn't afford that. And anyway, double for $1. Regular ones were 75 cents. I figured, who ever heard of having one martini? You're going to have two anyhow, so you might as well order the $1 one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. So I'd order the $1 one. I'd get to comparing my drink against the guy sitting next to me, and he'd have a 75 center. I'd kind of compare my drink to his, and I'd look at his and look at mine. But this isn't a double. It's a little larger than a 75 center. That's all. Who do they think they're kidding? You know, there's no double, so I better have another one. And then I'd have another one. Then I'd have another one. Then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and tell them, forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Then I'd head towards the beach, and I'd stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find. In the Los Angeles area, in California, you know, they got liquor store on every corner. And I'd stop and pick my spot where they had that cheap vodka. I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'm kind of a neat drunk. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully so the creases fall properly, you know, and put my shoes away and everything, and put my pajamas on, and be 2:15, 2:30, something like that. And I'd sit at the edge of the bed, and I'd untap that cheap vodka, and I'd take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows. And, whew, yeah, done it again today. Yeah, this cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. Then I put one of those old 78s on the turntable, you know, something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" You know? And then I'd go into my fantasy about starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. Starting tomorrow, I'm in sales. I can work any hours I want to. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to spend every waking moment earning money. You know, and I'm going to work from morning till night, starting tomorrow. And I'm going to get out of debt once and for all. I can't do anything about that marriage, but at least I get straightened up financially. Man, what a great idea. You know, sometimes I just startle myself. I come up with these wonderful ideas. You know? That's the solution to my problems. You know? And I'll get out of debt. And starting tomorrow, I'm not even going to drink starting tomorrow. And I'm going to work. I'm going to put a big red X on the calendar, and I'm going to work 365 days in a row and earn money every single day. You know, by the end of 365 days, I could just visualize. I could just see it. You know, I'll be out of debt. I'll have a new car paid for. In fact, I'll even buy her a car. I'll buy her a white Lincoln Continental car. And I'll drive it up to that house where she still lives. I'll stop and buy a beautiful card at the Hallmark card shop. And I'll write on, thanks for all the good years, H. You know, not Hank or Henry, just H. I don't know if you people here up here in Ocean Beach knows, but that kind of class, you know. And so then I get a gold-plated key and put it in with the card. And it'll have this sentimental poetry, you know, on it. And I'll put the gold-plated key in there. And then I'll drive up at midnight or 1 a.m. And I'll drive up and I'll take a right turn and I'll make a U-turn in the cul-de-sac and I'll coast up in front of the house, you know, real quietly. Park the car right in front of the house and I'll tiptoe up on the steps and put that envelope with the key in it down the mail slot there, and then I'll split. And next morning she'll go through her routine and she'll get her mail. And then she'll see that envelope, you know, no stamp on it. She'll wonder what that is, you know. So she'll open that first. And the key will drop out. And she'll think, well, I wonder what that key is. And then she'll read the poetry. And it'll be that sentimental, sticky kind of poetry. You know? And as she's reading it, tears will just roll down. And then she'll look over and she'll see, thanks for all the good years, H. And she'll once get to looking at that key and try to figure out what that key's for. And somehow she'll look out in front of the house and she'll see that car out there, brand new, sparkling, white Lincoln Continental. She'll see it out there. Then she'll put it together that that's her car. Then she'll be sorry, by God. I don't know about you, but I just love giving those expensive gifts. And I'd look up at the clock, and it'd say 10:45. It can't be 10:45. I just sat on here, you know. It just can't be that late. And then I'd realize I was almost out of booze. And geez, I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and I'd run 2 blocks to the liquor store. It closed at 11. I had to get there, you know. That's when I first started jogging, about that time. And I'd get there just as the place was closing, bottle Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands right around where I lived. I wouldn't want anybody to think I was cheap there in the neighborhood. Then I could stroll back to my shack in peace and contentment and security for the rest of the night. And I'd go on with my fantasy. And I would think, you know, 365 days from now, everything is going to be wonderful. I could just see it. You know, I could just see how wonderful it was going to be. So I started celebrating a job well done. And I get to thinking a little more, you know. And I think I'll work 2 years in a row, starting tomorrow. And, at the end of 2 years, I would have earned so much money that I'll buy myself a boat. And I'll take a year off, and I'll sail all over the world. I've been everywhere. I've been everywhere in the world that a boat can go, you know, in my fantasy, sitting on the edge of my bed. And it was wonderful, you know. Then I started rehearsing this speech I was going to have to give because I knew I was going to be salesman of the year. And somewhere in there, I'd pass out. And I'd wake up next morning, it'd be 10 o'clock. Instead of getting up at 6, here I am an hour late. Throw my clothes on, get in that car, weave in and out. I had to get there because I should have worked yesterday afternoon. I left all those papers. You know, what am I going to do? And today's the day I'm going to be fired. I know it. And I get there, everything appeared to be the same. And couldn't hardly wait until, 11:30 so I could go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And have my lunch, you know. And I'd go over there and make big decision of the day, whether to have the dollar one or the 75 cent. And then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd call and tell them. You know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. And that's the way it was. Through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, my wife and son moved back in with me. Our daughter had already split. She was smart enough to, you know, but my son was 16 years old. After they moved in, you know, she said, "I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you." And little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period, she had started to drink. And, you know, some of us get in trouble. I'm sure I was an alcoholic from the first drink, or at least that first drink at the bar anyway. But I got away with it for a long time. I got away with drinking for a long time. Alcohol was a social lubricant for me. It enabled me to dance and romance and do all the things that normal people seem to be able to do without that stuff, you know. But just give me a drink, and then I can go to the party. I can have a good time. Just keep a drink coming every once in a while. And I'm very social. I can do that social drinking. And then, of course, when I get home from the party, I drink a fifth of old Rotgut vodka. And that's the way it was. My wife, on the other hand, you know, some people, when they drink, they get in trouble the first time they get drunk. They have an accident something bad happens and they get thrown in jail or whatever it is, the first time they ever drank. And that's the kind of drinker she was. She's a very friendly, outgoing person when she didn't drink, but Jesus, give her one drink and all hell would break loose. And we could never drink together, ever. It's just impossible. We never, ever had a good time when we drank together. In fact, it was mayhem, really. I'm kind of a grouchy guy when I'm not drinking, but you give me a drink, and I don't care who you are. You're the most interesting person I've ever met in my entire life. I want to sit with you and talk with you and hear your life story. I'm prepared to sit up all night with you and hear your plans for the future. You know, as long as we got booze, I'm right there with you all the way. On the other hand, you know, she was an outgoing, friendly type person when she didn't drink. And she'd take one drink, and as she was blacking out, finishing her first drink, you know, then all hell would break loose. And she did stuff, I'm not here to talk about her and her, you know, but I think I will just tell you folks. Just a few of the things she did. Now it'll help you understand me and my problem. You know. Yeah. What warped me, you know. But she did stuff like throw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. She used to break my old phonograph records. God, don't break that. That's a collector's item. You can't replace it. Good. Bang. I never want to hear that damn thing again, you know. And I like music when I drink. I don't know about you folks, but sometimes I just get hung up on a trumpet toot, you know. I don't know if you've ever done anything like this, but I'd lay that needle in there, toot, oh man, that is really great. And get the needle in and set it up there again, you know, toot, oh man, yeah. used the driver crazy, you know. And that's the kind of drinking was going on at my place. And only it was a lot worse, you know. And I'd come home from work, same thing, get up late, go to work late, and get home early, change into my pajamas, I'm sitting there, here comes my son home from school. Be 2:30 in the afternoon. And he'd come in, and I'd say, you know, I don't know who you think you're kidding. School doesn't even get out till 3. You're already home here at 2:30, you know. And I'd stand there in my pajamas with a bottle of vodka in my hand, and I'd ask him, how the hell do you ever expect to amount to anything? You know, if you don't apply yourself in this world, my son, you haven't got a chance. I'm really worried about you. You know, he'd look at me funny, and he always had, I don't know, 5 or 6 guys with him, and they all looked at me funny. And so that's, you know, that's the way it was. And we went to group therapy off and on for 15 years or more, you know, trying to figure out what it is, what's going on, you know. And about the only thing I got out of group therapy or private therapy, for that matter, is that my mother-in-law had grave emotional problems. You know, if she didn't, why was she always at my house? Yeah. And why did she stay and stay and stay, you know? Why don't you get a life? My God, you know. And so we went to group therapy again, try to go one more time, you know, try to figure out what was wrong. I'm gonna get sober. Anyhow, this therapist, you know, he asked me, he said, you really drink as much as she says? And I says, hell yeah, I do. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't marry to a woman like that? Yeah. I got 2 of the worst kids you could possibly imagine, a pressure job, so I drink, you know. So what? They've never missed a meal. You know, they've always had a decent place to live. They've always had medical care, braces on their teeth, whatever they needed, they always had it. You know. So I drink. So what? You know? And he said, have you ever thought of quitting? I said, as a matter of fact, I have. I'm going to, starting tomorrow. You know. And he said, you know, have you ever thought of going to AA? And I said, no, thank you. Thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA. And I had gone to a meeting 2 or 3 years prior to that. And the meeting I went to in the Los Angeles area, they give chips, but different than they do here in the southern part of the country. At that meeting, I gave the chips at the beginning of the meeting. And they said, guy, they didn't have the surrender chip. And the guy asked, is there anyone here had just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get your chip and say a few words. So here comes this guy up, you know, and he gets his chip. My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights and the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And I just love everybody, you know. Just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down to plant. I just can't begin to tell you how wonderful my life has become now that I quit drinking. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. Jeez, you know. Is that guy kidding? What is going on here? You know, and And then the guy said, anyone else? And here comes this little lady running up, boy, and gets her chip, her 30-day chip. My name's Mary Smith. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love everybody, you know. And not just the people in AA. I love everybody in the whole world. You know, a short time ago when my children looked my way, there was a look of fear in their eyes. Now when our eyes meet, there's a look of respect. And I've noticed lately that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And it's just a wonderful, glorious way of life. And I wake up in the morning, I reach over and grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand together. And my children were failing in school. Now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States offering free scholarships. And I just can't begin to tell you how wonderful my life has become now that I quit drinking and go on AA. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I just couldn't believe what was going on. It just made my flesh crawl. And I wasn't able to attend the whole meeting that night. I needed a drink. I went and got one, or about 20, you know. And, this guy asked me, you know, hey, I said, thanks, but no thanks. I've already been AA. It's some kind of a religious cult of some kind. I said I'm not sure what it is, to tell you the truth, but it's nothing I'd be interested in. And you know, I don't think I'd have come back if it wasn't for her. She made a suicide attempt and went back to a doctor that had told us that to go to AA. Told me to go to AA, and she was there and heard that, and he said that his wife was in the program, and so she went back to that doctor and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic, and he said he didn't know, but why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? She'd be happy to take her. And that's what happened, and that's why I'm standing here this morning, is because she went to AA. And to be a good guy, every now and then I would go to a meeting with her, and I hated the meetings. But be a good guy and go with her, and I could hardly wait for the meetings to be over so I could get a drink. Yeah, and one Sunday, I got the pressure put on me to go to this anniversary meeting they were having down at the club, and so I went to it. They were going to have a speaker that day and all that, and I heard this speaker talk, and he gave a funny talk, and I laughed, and I wasn't laughing much back then. You know, about the only time I laughed back then is if I saw you fall down and hurt yourself, you know. But he made me laugh, and towards the end of his talk he said, you know, of all the things that I've done, drunk and sober, in my life, he says, I've been able to make amends and get forgiveness for the things I've done. And he says, what I'm having trouble right now dealing with, he says, are the things I haven't done. He said, the things I should have done, the sins of omission. And I thought, Jesus, that's me. I hadn't identified with any speakers. I thought it was all a bunch of baloney, you know, what they were saying. And only I didn't use that term. I just didn't believe what was going on. And he said, you know, there's a thing, better father. I should have, you know, and I should have been a better worker. I should have. And it really hit me hard. And I couldn't wait for that meeting to be over so I could go get a drink. Because I can't stand the truth about myself. You know, don't tell me the truth about me. I can just barely handle the truth about you guys, you know. But don't tell me the truth about me. You know, I can't deal with it. You know, I just can't deal with it. And the only way I deal with a feeling like that is I have a drink to wash it away, to postpone thinking about it. And so I drank after hearing that talk. But eventually I went to AA. I finally got sober, and I went to AA, and I was sitting in a meeting after about 2 weeks after I took my last drink. I was sitting there. I was really angry that I had to quit drinking. I knew I couldn't drink anymore. And I knew you guys were talking about one day at a time. But I knew the hidden message there was, ever again. You can never, ever drink again. That's what you're really talking about. You know? And it's one day at a time. It sounds kind of good, but, you know, forever. And just anger just set in, you know. I had just completed about 30 years of drinking, you know. I've got this rotten wife and two of the worst kids you could possibly imagine, a pressure job, I owe money to everybody, it's all past due, and now I can't even drink. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Nothing. That's what I'm going to do. Nothing. There's nothing to do if you don't drink. I don't care how great it is, how these people in AA say how wonderful it is. You know, I can't drink anymore. I'm never going to ever have a decent time as long as I live. It's going to be one long great tunnel, you know, and then I'll die, and that's it, you know. And my life is over. I can't even go to a decent restaurant ever again, you know. Because, you know, I'm stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. Because you go into a nice place, and they always serve liquor in nice restaurants. And what's the first thing they want to know when you go into a restaurant? Would you like a cocktail before dinner? And you can't say to them, well, yeah, I'd like one, but, you know, I've got this disease. You know, and it's of a twofold nature. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. And if I can't, you know, if I take even one drink, I can't predict my behavior. And if it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one. You know? I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. In fact, I used to spend about 90% of my day back then explaining things to people, you know. And that's one of the things that I've tried to do here in AA the last several years, and it's a difficult thing, is to stop explaining. You know, I don't know if there's any explainers out there or not, but I got, you know, what happens to me, I'll go 2 or 3 days without explaining anything, and then invariably I find myself explaining. And I end up, you know, and I always start from the day I was born. Then bring you up to date and all the pros and cons and ramifications. You know, I want you to understand. But now, when I do that, I catch myself right in mid-explanation. And I a little thing goes off in my brain. You're explaining again. Oh, yeah. And so the bad news for you explainers is I just stop right in mid-explanation. And you know, they never ever noticed the difference. Yeah. It turns out no one's listening to your explanations. No one's a damn bit interested in finding out why you haven't done something that you should have done in the first place. And I'm trying to quit, but it's not easy. Yeah. And I got a sponsor. And I went to this group in L.A., and the format of that meeting was 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and then a main speaker, an hour and a half meeting. A lot of the meetings in Los Angeles area are an hour and a half. And they pick the 10-minute speakers on the way in. You never know when you're going to get tagged to be a 10-minute speaker, you know. And so you walk in there, and the guy said to me, after my second or third meeting attending there, he says, "Hank, you're the second 10-minute speaker tonight." I said, "You're kidding, you know." I said, "I'm new." He said, "That's okay." Just, you know. I said, "No, that's not okay." I said, I just had the worst day of my entire life. And I said, "I couldn't possibly share with anybody." And he said, that's okay. We understand." I said, "I just don't seem to be getting through to you, you know." And he says, "What are you saying? That you pass?" I said, "That's it. I pass." And I says, "Catch me in about 6 months, and I'll be happy to do it." He says, "We don't pass at this meeting. At this meeting, if you're asked to do anything, we consider it an AA request, and you never, ever turn down an AA request." I don't know what to say. And he says, "Well, why don't you just go in and sit down and enjoy the meeting?" And he says, and maybe next week you just find another meeting you can go to and be a spectator." And I said, "Man, that's a cold shot, you know." and he says, "You know, Hank," he says, this looks like fun and games here. You know, you see everybody hugging and shaking hands and joking and laughing and everything. It looks like fun and games. But this is life and death. And unless you participate in your own recovery, you're not going to have a recovery." And he says, you can go to any number of meetings all over, he says, "and just sit there and turn down everything anytime anybody asks you to do anything. Then you can just sit there and be a spectator and be on the fringes of AA forever." You know. And I said, "Oh God, all right, I'll talk." You know. And so they call my name, and I got up and I said, "My name's Hank Johnson, I'm an alcoholic and I hate AA." I said, "I've got almost 6 months of sobriety," and I said, "I see all you guys, and it all seems like it's getting better for you guys. But," I said, "it's getting worse for me, you know." I said, I'm having trouble. We're, you know, getting back to trying to make it with my wife again and the kids and try to pay my bills and become a citizen in the community again and all this stuff. And I said, "It's just getting harder and harder, and I'm just hanging on by my fingernails. And I don't know when I'm going to drink again, you know, but I'm dangerously close." And I just went on and on and on like that for 10 minutes. And finally, you know, I got through, and they all clapped, you know. Yeah, I just amazed. They all clapped, and then they had 10-minute coffee break, and that's when the miracle of AA happened for me. Right then, you know, because I got unconditional acceptance from about 200 people, you know, and I could feel it was genuine, and I got unconditional love from about 200 people. It was overwhelming. You know, I've never been so high in all my life as I was at that moment. You know, because I didn't, if I would have had more time, if I'd have known I was going to give that 10-minute talk, I would have rehearsed something. You know, and I would have gone to the big book, and I would have gleam some of those great lines out of there, you know, and maybe I would have written them down like I see sometimes people do, and come up to the podium and really lay those lines on you, you know, those terrific lines in the book, and I would have been phony, but I expressed my feelings as and I was honest. I told the truth, and they still accepted me. And that's when the miracle of AA happened. And I didn't have to look good. And so from that moment until right now, I'm not sure I've ever turned down an AA request. I can't remember ever turning down one. I've never turned one down consciously. And it's been a wonderful, wonderful thing. Yeah. However, that's, you know, I was far from being out of it. I remember calling my sponsor up. I still was having trouble getting to work, you know. And I called him up one Monday morning, and I said, you know, I'm not going to be able to go to all these meetings you want me to attend, you know. And he says, oh, why not? You know. I says, well, I said, I've been thinking about the situation, and I says, you know, I went to group therapy and private therapy for over 15 years. And I says, but I was drinking then. I'm sober now. And I've decided I'm going to go back to therapy. And I'm going to get a good psychiatrist. You know, I'm going to find out who the best one in the Los Angeles area is. I don't care how much it costs. If I have to go into debt, I don't care. But I'm gonna find out what's truly wrong with me. I know I'm an alcoholic, but there were some underlying problems here that I can't put my finger on, and I'm gonna really get into it. He said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm at home." He says, "Well, it's 10 o'clock in the morning." He says, "I've already been to work for about an hour and a half." He said, "There's nothing psychologically wrong with you this morning." He said, "You're just not where you're supposed to be right now, that's all. And you're feeling kind of uncomfortable about it." He says, "Get dressed and go to work. That's where you belong. That's the place you belong right now." And he says, "You'll be embarrassed when you get to work, but, you know, that'll be over in a few minutes, and then call me." And I went to work, you know, and I was embarrassed when I got there a little late. And I sat at my desk, and everything seemed to be okay. And I called him. I said, "You're right, I do feel better." And it turns out, in my case, I don't have any deep, dark psychological problems. I'm just lazy, that's all. I don't want to do these things that you... I understand that you have to do them, you know. But, you know, I don't want to do them, you know. You understand? You know, what I want to do, I want to fantasize about how the world should be. And I want to think about how it all should be and how wonderful it all could be and all that. But I don't want to do any of the work to make it that way. I want you to accept me and love me, you know, and understand that in my case, I don't have to do these steps or any of the stuff, you know. So that was a big lesson to me. Whenever I'm antsy, whenever there's something wrong, whenever there's, you know, so it's generally because I'm not where I should be at the moment. And a lot of times, in my case, when I'm in trouble, it's never what I've done. It's always what I haven't done. I haven't paid my bills. I haven't, whatever it is, you know. And so I have to sit down and make a list of what needs to be done and then start doing it. And it's amazing. You know, if I go through the day doing the next indicated thing all day and scratch those things off the list, by the time my head hits the pillow, you know, and I lay back there or lie back there, my new wife is... into English, I can't say a word. I'm very inhibited around her because she... I don't know if it's lie or lay. I don't know. But anyhow, when I lie back, I've used them both, so I'm right part of the time. And you know, and I lay back there and I listen. I just kind of hear something, you know, and it's some spiritual thing, because that's when I feel spiritual, when I've gone through the day doing what I'm supposed to be doing, when I'm supposed to be doing it, something happens to me, and I feel spiritual. I have a little trouble with the prayers and all that. And I don't mean that they're not good, and they're indicated, and I do them. But by taking action that I don't really want to take, by doing it anyhow, somehow I feel more spiritual than I do saying prayers. I know there's a meeting in Charlotte, and I've met people of the cloth all over AA, but there's a meeting in Charlotte where there's four ministers. You know, there's a priest, Catholic priest, there's an Episcopal priest, there's a Lutheran minister, and a Baptist. And they're all sitting there at the meeting. And I wonder, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, those guys know the words. Those guys can really pray, I'm sure, any of them, you know, you can, they can tell you those prayers, you know. But, you know, if you talk to each, I have talked to each one of those people individually, and they say they didn't get spiritual until they came to AA. And, you know, and if you read the book, Father Dowling, that helped Bill so much, he said he wasn't even an alcoholic, and he got spiritual doing the steps. So, that's what I need to do. I need to do the steps and do the next indicated thing. And I'm very, very grateful to be sober. My sobriety date is December the 29th, 1969. And my son that used to look at me so funny back then when he was 16, he finally turned himself into AA when he was 21 years old. And I'm going out to Santa Barbara. He lives in a big 5-bedroom home overlooking the Pacific Ocean up on a butte there, you know, and can see the ocean from three sides of his house, and he's up there. I never thought that kid would ever make I thought he'd be on relief, or that my relief, probably. And he makes a lot of money, you know. And I'm going to go out there in May, on May the 27th. He's going to celebrate 25 years of sobriety, if he makes it. And he was the young people speaker at the Palm Springs Roundup about 20 years ago. And I helped him. He asked me to come and help him buy a suit, you know. And he bought him, you know, bought a nice looking suit and a new shirt and tie, and got his hair styled, and he had shiny shoes, and he's standing up there on the stage, and there was about 1,200 people sitting out in the audience, and my wife and I were out there and listening, you know. And he said, "My name's Matt Johnson. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm the son of a drunken mother and a drunken father." And my wife and I looked at each other. We just burst into tears. We were so damn proud. Yeah. And you know, I'm positive that this is a family disease, and it's in our blood, in our Swedish blood, you know. Now, we're alcoholics, man, you know. We drink to solve problems or make them go away for a while. And I'm sure my son caught it from me. But if it wasn't from me, it was from his mother's side of the family, you know, because they were alcoholics. And so I'm sure that it's in his genes. But, you know, I don't take the blame for his drinking. He did his own drinking. He should have known not to drink, you know. He observed two drunken parents, you know, but he drank. But I'm not taking the blame for his drinking. I talked to people this last week, talking to a woman that was so felt so bad that her son was an alcoholic. And I said, well, if he knows it, maybe that's part of the, you know, maybe it's time that he'll do something about it. But she was taking the blame. I'm not taking the blame for my son's drinking. And I'm also not taking the credit for his recovery. He did both things on his own. And I'm really delighted to be here at this conference. You know, very seldom I go to a conference that I haven't heard at least one or two of the speakers. In this case, I've not heard any of the speakers except me, and I'm tired of my talk, I'll tell you that. About the only thing that I can absolutely tell you folks for sure that I know positively is what I heard at that first meeting I ever attended, and that is that this is a spiritual program. And I know that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Great message. And if you didn't get your car, better go get it quick. For those who would choose, we'll close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For God is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.